My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Hello, and welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Firstly, I want to say thank you once again for another brilliant week for the show. The growth still stuns me, so thank you from the bottom of my heart for your support. I said the other day online that I still expect one day to wake up and see that nobody's downloaded the show and nobody's listening anymore. So that's not me being a bit needy. That's me being honest, because I'm still stunned by the reaction we get and the positive feedback. It really does mean a lot. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for that. It's just keeps growing week in, week out. And when I see where around the world people listen to the podcast, it just blows my mind. I know I use that term far too many times, but we've got people listening, you know, countries like Sweden, South Africa, Japan, the Seychelles, Colombia, Russia, Nigeria, Argentina, obviously the USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, Ireland, Germany, Portugal. It just sometimes is too much to take in. So I appreciate each and every single person that listens to the show. Thank you so much. I've also just finished watching the second season of Hellier, which I found incredibly interesting, especially as I'm both a big fan of the work of John Keel and also Greg and Dana Newkirk. So if you've not seen it, I recommend it highly on Amazon Prime. Check it out. It's 10 episodes and it'll pull you along and keep you enthralled throughout them all. This week, I'm delighted to welcome back Alexander Petikoff. And we're going to be discussing his upcoming documentary, Lions of the East, which covers the witness accounts of people seeing mountain lions in states and areas where the authorities clearly have stated mountain lions are extinct. Alex's film takes us on a journey into the heart of northeastern America to look at these sightings, speak to the witnesses, and get out there in the woods to see exactly what is going on. As usual, before we dive into the interview, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Please subscribe to us on YouTube. And don't forget to leave us a nice review on your podcast app to help continue the show to build and grow new listeners. Right. Let's go on the search for the Lions of the East. My guest today is filmmaker Alexander Petikoff. Alex returns to Mysteries and Monsters to discuss his compelling new documentary, Lions of the East, which examines the decades of sightings of mountain lions and mystery big cats in the New England area. Alex, delighted to welcome you back, sir. How are we?
Great. How are you doing, my friend?
We are very good on this side of the pond, thank you. All well and good. So, we were just having a quick chat before we went live. All the way back on one of my debut episodes, episode 7 now. So, lovely to have you back. And when we spoke back in April, you were just about to start. You were working on the documentary Lions of the East. So what's it about, and what drew you to take this subject on after your previous work, Alex?
Sure. Yeah. So that was kind of, I was doing interviews right on that time period. And it's essentially, it's an examination of the mountain lion and sort of mystery big cat phenomena in New England, as you summed up earlier. But more than that, it's kind of about the people that are involved and some of the sort of conspiracies around it. And, you know, I use that word somewhat lightly, but there's a distrust that's been bred with the public about this subject. And a couple of the interviews I've done as well kind of involved really confirmable DNA evidence that was kind of covered up in a way by the fish and game and the sort of the government institutions that function on that level. My interest in this subject was really sparked by just growing up in the region. We have a lot of forest here, and there's probably no one who hasn't heard a story of somebody saying they saw a mountain lion or they had a mountain lion sighting, and they're not supposed to be here. That's what I think a lot of people don't understand, is that mountain lions are technically extirpated or extinct in this region. Now, that doesn't mean the species are extinct. So puma concolor, the mountain lion, cougar, panther, there's different regional names that still exist as a species out west, and its established range is kind of the western United States. But there are sightings all up and down the East Coast in areas where these creatures used to be, but they were mostly hunted out in the late 1800s, and a lot of the, especially New England, where a lot of the forests were actually cut down, majority of the forests were taken down, and that's also contributed to lessening of the population. But these sightings have been going on pretty much since that time period, since they were supposed to be extinct, and they've been sort of increasing and almost crescendoing. So it's been pretty interesting, and that's really what sparked my interest in this. And in particular, when I was in university in 2011 in the state of Connecticut, which is a very small, fairly urban state, you know, it's only about an hour from New York City where I was. There was a story of a mountain lion that was killed virtually on the outskirts of New York City. And it was just a very bizarre story. And it was struck by a car. They did an autopsy and DNA testing and found that its genetic makeup was from South Dakota, which is very far from Connecticut. Mm. So that case in particular has always been interesting. And that's one of the only confirmed cases in New England, of all places. So those I think factors help contribute to this, and I just think it's something that keeps coming up whenever I do events or any of these kind of talks. The mountain lion phenomenon always comes up. You know, you hear about Bigfoot sightings, UFO sightings, of course, but this one probably more than others because it's a little bit more mundane, let's say.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's the compelling factor for me, especially in reports from the United States, Alex, is the fact that there are established populations, you know, all down the western coast of the US and Canada, and obviously across slightly in the middle into sort of New Mexico and Arizona. But like you say, officially they were, you know, hunted to extinction over a century ago in the eastern side, and especially in the New England and maritime regions. But it's like you say, there seems to have been a constant chatter from people out in the woods and in the mountains that they, on occasions, they've bumped into these creatures, and as you refer to there, the fact that that cat was killed in Connecticut and its DNA was, you know, I think it was 1500 miles away, 2000 miles away, South Dakota from where this cat was found, it's not surprising. Because we know cats, especially males, have massive ranges.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about it all is that if you look at where the established range is, or what most scientists, biologists, and academics would say is the kind of established range of the mountain lion, you can find confirmed examples of specimens or DNA evidence that's been found throughout the Midwestern states, where there's a lot of forest as well, and it kind of it gets a little bit sparser towards the East Coast, but there's still a great amount of reports. What I mean by confirmed cases are examples of verifiable evidence where people found scat or DNA, or were able to use multiple methods to identify a creature. So let's say they found tracks and there was a trail camera photo. This has happened in multiple places and throughout the South as well. Mm. So it's not controversial to say that these animals are moving eastward. They're just kind of entering back into their natural range. I mean, there's no borders between any of the states in America, you know, aside from a dotted line on a map and just a little sign that says, welcome to West Virginia or Pennsylvania. There's nothing that can stop really animals from moving in. And you have sort of an ecological niche that they're going to fill. They're an apex predator, more so than the black bear, which is abundant throughout the East Coast, especially in New England. I mean, Maine, the state of Maine, which is the most heavily forested state in the U.S., has about 30,000 black bear by estimate. But mountain lions are obviously more of a apex predator than they are. But what's interesting about this subject is then you have people who believe that the eastern mountain lion never actually went extinct, that it never, that there were small pockets that managed to survive and clung to their existence and perhaps are now mixing with the western cats that are moving out here, which is a phenomena that even government officials I've interviewed have been willing to admit. They say, you know, at any given point, there could be a mountain lion walking through New Hampshire or Vermont or Massachusetts, as is happened, you know, it's been proven in some cases that they're coming from the western populations. But it's interesting then to talk to those folks who claim there's older origins. I mean, I've come across literature and even heard of reports from researchers as far back as the 1920s and 30s were saying they were seeing mountain lions. And this was, you know, maybe 30, 40 years after they were supposed to have been completely killed off. I mean, a lot of the New England states, you have stuffed mountain lions, which are in museums usually, which are kind of the last mountain lion that was killed. I think the last one in Maine was like in the 1910s or 1920s, but the other states, such as Vermont and New Hampshire, were 1870s, 1880s, and they have up in museums, and you find out the whole backstory. I mean, I was taken out to a spot by Joseph Citro, who's a Vermont folklorist and a, you know, wonderful author who has seen a mountain lion, but he took me out to a spot in the spring in a place called Wethersfield, Vermont, and we went to this little cave. And that's apparently where the second to last mountain lion was killed in Vermont, where they trapped it in there and stuck a shotgun in there and killed it. And I actually crawled into the cave and lost my GoPro in the process. I left it in there. Excellent. So then I had to send, you know, poor Joe back there the next day after I'd gone home saying, retrieve my GoPro. And then he did that, which was kind of a funny moment for both. But yeah, so it really is interesting because it opens up a lot of possibilities. Now, when you talk to most government sort of people, and when I say government, I'm not talking about, you know, men in black. I'm talking in the U.S. we have fish and game agencies or fish and wildlife, Department of Wildlife. It depends from state to state. And they basically conserve the natural resources, and they're the ones that issue hunting permits, and there's often game wardens, and they'll monitor poaching and illegal fishing, trapping, those kinds of things. I mean, a lot of people have probably seen the show Northwoods Law. On the Animal Planet, and that's has to do with game wardens in New Hampshire and Maine. So that's the kind of role that they do. Most of those people are pretty down to earth, and they'll admit, yeah, there probably are mountain lions walking through this area. One of the wardens that I interviewed from Vermont, who is now pretty high up in the fish and game there in Vermont, said that, you know, they get reports all the time, and he thinks they're pretty credible, but he can't just tell someone, oh, you saw a mountain lion, therefore, there are mountain lions in Vermont. There has to be more of a verifiable sort of a trail of evidence, so to speak.
Yeah. I think it's that fact that, that the official line is from Fish and Game in that particular area. They aren't there. And if anybody is seeing, there is that possibility of it being a transient, just passing through, having a look round. But the other thing that, that I find quite compelling about what's going on over there is that it's very interesting that, that there are some populations, such as the hogs and the deers, that have exploded over the last 30 years. And common sense would tell you, big cats know where food is, and they'll come.
Yeah, that opens a very interesting avenue. So here in New England specifically, we have a huge deer, I don't want to say problem, but a big overpopulation of deer. So getting a hunting permit to go hunt a deer is going to be fairly easy compared to something like a moose, a bear, I guess. But down south, they have hogs, which are extremely harmful to the environment. I mean, they have a very short gestation period, so the females can have litters, huge litters, I think twice a year. I think that's what they told me when I was down south back last spring. And they have these huge ruts in the forest. It just looks like a dinosaur came through and ripped half the forest off. And they're probably the most vicious animal you encounter out there. When I was in Arkansas, in Louisiana, you know, I wasn't worried about gators because they're pretty docile unless you step on a nest or something. I was worried about a big hog coming through, you know, and you better have something locked and loaded, high caliber, you know, firearm if you're hoping to survive a hog encounter. So what's interesting is this is a motif I've come across time and time again, and not only in New England but other places, of people saying that there is a sort of conspiracy where various agencies are actually bringing mountain lions in to help control either the hog or the deer population. I've heard that in upstate New York. I've heard that in Arkansas, other places. And that kind of opens up another avenue to the conspiracy, because I don't think there's a, you know, grand sort of conspiracy. I think most of this has to do with money. Hmm. The fact that states won't say, oh, yeah, we have a population of mountain lion, is dealing with a mountain lion is a lot different than a black bear. A lot of times, especially around here, black bears in the tourist areas will start digging through the rubbish, and they'll get used to that, and they won't be afraid of people. And unfortunately, a lot of times they have to terminate those animals and kill them. But mountain lions, as I mentioned, totally different beasts, so to speak. So there's the issue of money and dealing with that. And a lot of states out west obviously have their own protocols, and there have been some recent attacks. They're not as common as people would imagine. Generally don't go for humans unless it's a juvenile that's inexperienced, or they see that you're somehow weak and, you know, frail or something like that. But yeah, that conspiracy motif just all over the place.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting as well that you can draw some compelling parallels, because it's very interesting, because obviously the same kind of thing seems to be going on in the east of Canada, where the officials say, nah, there's no cougar mountain lion population up here at all. And exactly the same thing is coming from the locals and the hunters and the people out there. Yes, there are. We know they're still here. And yet it's the same in England, because obviously we don't have a big cat population at all. And we've got sightings going back 40, 50, 60 years. Mm-hmm. Australia is another one, where exactly the same thing is going, especially Australia. There is no big cat population that's ever been there. They're not there at all. And yet hundreds of people have seen them over the last 100 years. It's peculiar that these experienced people who can spot the rest of the animals in the woods are apparently mistaken when they come across a cougar where it's not supposed to be.
Right. Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point. I mean, that's something I've heard about since as far back as I can remember. My interest in cryptozoology and the unknown was the alien big cats in England, in the UK, you know, what you guys have over there, Australia as well. Like, they're not supposed to be there. Here we have sort of an explanation for it. But, you know, you mentioned a good example in Eastern Canada. It's the same exact thing. There was actually one interesting case where a woman had got a confirmed video of a mountain lion in a field, very open area, where you could clearly see it was a mountain lion. This was in, I think, New Brunswick, which is one of the eastern provinces there, the Maritimes of Canada.
Yeah.
And it was actually bordering Maine. And in that, a couple towns over from where that video was taken, a guy had a trail camera photo of what he believed was a mountain lion. And you couldn't really tell very well, but, you know, the Maine officials kind of said, oh, it's probably a bobcat. But I mean, the fact that it happened a couple miles from where this video of a mountain lion was taken, I mean, like I said, even though there is it's an international border between Maine and Canada, I mean, I've seen most of that border. It's just forest. There's just trees. There's nothing stopping people, let alone, you know, animals or anything coming through that border. But I think what's interesting then, you know, because this is, for the most part, what I'm talking about is that when I say mundane, we're talking about the tawny or the brown, the lightish yellow-colored mountain lions that most people have seen on nature documentaries or probably at zoos. But then you have this element of the Black Panther, which is another motif that keeps showing up across the country. And I've heard of even reports, one of the reports going back to the 1930s in New Hampshire, somebody claiming it was a mountain lion. I think it turned out to – or a Black Panther, rather. And it turned out to be a big dog, but – just goes to show, even back then, this was on people's minds. And majority of the reports are of the tawny, sort of normal mountain lion. But then you have that element of the Black Panthers that shows up certainly in the UK and Australia and across the United States. But mountain lions are not supposed to show melanism. There aren't any known examples, at least according to science. So that opens up another can of worms. So in my project, I kind of look on that a little bit. Not dwelling on that completely, because I think the phenomena itself, for the most part, is wholly just dealing with the mountain lions. But there are multiple, there could be multiple things going on at the same time. You know, we could have these western cats, which certainly are coming to the east. That's been established. I think there's no doubt in my mind, and in a lot of the people who investigate this. Then you could possibly have remnant populations of the eastern cats in the far reaches of northern Maine and New Hampshire and really mountainous forested areas that never were logged as heavily as some of the other areas. Maybe they survived. And then you have this Black Panther phenomena. I mean, how many escaped pets can there be? There have, you know, how many escaped exotic pets spanning across three different continents can there be? I mean, sure, there's an element of that, definitely. And there's been some DNA in New England of mountain lions, supposedly, that have shown that they're of South American origin, which would have meant, you know, they're mountain lions from the Andes or down in Chile or wherever the case may be, but that's certainly not all of it. So there's a lot. There seems like a lot of things going on, and you know, I kind of went into it thinking it's going to be pretty simple, pretty cut and dry, but actually, it's a lot more complex.
Yeah, and I think the sad fact about all this is, you know, as we mentioned about the cat that was killed outside of Connecticut, it's going to take one of two things for somebody in officialdom to either admit it or take this phenomenon seriously, and that's either another one gets killed with, you know, a pregnant female or something like that, or a member of the public meets a tragic end. And I think it's a real shame that death seems to be the only way to conclusively prove sometimes to officials that these things are going on.
Yeah, that's, you know, without putting too much blame on the officials, because you know governments tend to get bad enough reputation from pretty much every element of society and political persuasion. You know, and there are great people that work for these agencies, and
Yes,
some of these fish and game people that I've talked to, game wardens. I mean, they're fantastic, and you know, they kind of have to toe a line in a lot of cases. But an example, I think, that's sort of interesting of this would be the great white sharks here in Massachusetts on Cape Cod. Where we had this resurgence of seal populations from the 1970s when they were basically all killed off. And then there was a Mammal Protection Act that was passed through Congress, and culling seals was then outlawed. And seal populations have now reached upwards of 70,000. And with that, you know, Cape Cod is a very famous kind of summer resort. All of New England kind of heads down there to the beach. It's you know, it's very idyllic. It's where Jaws was filmed. I mean, I think coincidentally with this story. But great whites started to come back to that area. And people, you know, we knew they were there. It's if you look in the past decade, the increase of sightings and shark spottings and entire conservancies that were started around it. And then this past last summer, there were two attacks, one non-fatal and one fatal. And then I think that's when people started really kind of taking it a little bit more seriously. And I think that's unfortunately what it took, because most people, you know, there's a lot of business involved. It's kind of like in the movie Jaws. You know, they don't want to shut the beach down because of you know, the hearsay about the shark until it's too late. And that's another kind of example of that. And I don't know if with the mountain lions it'll take something like that, because like I said, attacks are fairly rare if you look across North America, but you do hear about them, and when you do, they're pretty high profile. Or you'll see one of these videos of somebody hiking and they come face to face with a mountain lion. Or you know, one of the stories was a jogger in Colorado got attacked by a juvenile, and I think he survived because he choked it to death, but pretty much only because it was a juvenile. So, yeah, a lot of the times you need that overwhelming sort of evidence to really, you know, prove that this could be going on. And I think, unfortunately, in the case of mountain lions in New England, we have a couple of cases, especially some of the people I interviewed. One was a lady in 2016 who had her horse attacked by something,
Yes.
and the state said that it was owner negligence that was the result of the horse injuries. And you know, people who have horses are very into their horses. I mean, those are like their children. That enraged her to no end. So she scoured the property and found multiple areas where there was blood trailing on the bottom of fence posts, which was not the horse's blood. There were tufts of hair stuck in the fence. So there was some kind of altercation that happened. It looks like the larger horse sort of stepped in when the smaller one was probably mounted by this mountain lion to be attacked in that sort of fashion that big cats attack larger prey. And the DNA they found a couple months later came back as male mountain lion. You know, they contacted the state. The state said, okay, we need to find a lab to do mutual sort of tests, a place we both agree on to reestablish this. And they chose another university, I think out west. Came to the same results, and then people stopped answering phone calls. The samples were never returned, but she never sent all her samples in. So I actually followed up with her a couple weeks ago, And she said that there had been another attack in her same town in rural Massachusetts of possibly a mountain lion, but another was like livestock, cows, I think, or something got attacked, which is very odd for black bears to do, because if bears are the only big predators around here, they usually don't, they're not as aggressive as big cats, I mean, for the most part. So that's what's pretty interesting.
It is as well, because I was going to mention that particular lady, because there's a clip in the trailer that shows the wound.
Yeah.
And you know, at the end, you know, I'm not going to pretend I'm a biologist of any stretch of the imagination, but to someone like me looking at that, that clearly looks like a claw mark across just below the neck, which is typical cat attack territory. That's cats go for the throat always.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting. It is a little hard to tell, because apparently what happened was, you know, they did find a piece of this fence post, like 10 feet away from where there was a latch actually on a gate for a metal, you know, there's a little pen where they keep the horses. And the latch was found bent and twisted in another area of the yard. So there was some kind of an altercation, and where this particular latch locked in, that's where there's scratch marks on the fence post, and there was a hair, that's where she found it. And right after that is where there's a blood trail from the mountain lion. I mean, this thing could have gone off, walked off in the woods and died 50 feet off their property. And they'll never know, because they didn't, at the time, they thought it was a bear or a dog. They had no idea it would be a mountain lion. This is the last thing they thought. But the injury itself, it's unclear if that was from an actual claw or the horse perhaps getting spooked and hitting itself on the gate. But the pressure of the, I mean, it's hard to try and piece it together, but the tufts of hair being stuck in the fence with that force, the homeowners believe that perhaps the larger horse had kicked the mountain lion into it, and that's perhaps broken the latch, and that's why it kind of, it, the mountain lion itself started bleeding, and as it walked off, it left a trail of blood on the fence, and the other horse perhaps had sustained the injury from the claw or from the crash. I mean, it's very hard to say unless you had a camera out there, but it's a very interesting encounter, and I think the way it's been treated and kind of hushed up really says a lot about sort of the treatment of it and the treatment of this phenomenon. I think it just breeds distrust with the public.
Yes.
Because I've talked to so many people, and I've had, you know, probably almost 100 encounters at this point. People have told me over social media since last year, even personal friends that I had no idea, saying, oh yeah, I saw mountain lion hunting when I was growing up in Vermont, that kind of thing. People say, oh yeah, the government knows, they're covering it up. You know, it's a very they're very nonchalant about it. And I think that's an attitude that's been created by a lot of the decisions that have been made about this subject.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very interesting point as well. Because one of the most famous examples of government officials being caught out was on the cryptozoological show called Animal X, which is on Amazon Prime. And in the second season, they went to Australia looking for Australia's mystery big cats. And it was the same kind of thing. You got lots of ranchers and bushmen, absolutely 100% convinced that there was large cats out there. And so somebody came up and said, oh, yeah, I've sent scat to the officials, and they always tell me it's dog or roo or wombat. He said, it's ridiculous. I know where it is. So they
right.
went to a zoo and got some lion poo, filmed it, so showed them getting this poo from the lion cage at the local zoo, sent it in, and the official DNA result came back as dog.
Wow.
And then they wouldn't respond to the calls when they rang to tell them what they'd done. They wouldn't deal with it at all. They didn't want to know.
Oh, I love that show. I don't remember that episode specifically, but I remember the Megalania one. That
yes.
Was
Yeah,
that was definitely my favorite. But yeah, that's, you know, speaking of that, the other, without giving out too much, you know, about the documentary, but the other story was actually, I was contacted by a guy who's a biologist who's, you know, very, has a great set of credentials, has worked with mountain lions out west. He had found a scat sample in the mountains of New Hampshire in 2001 and sent that out to a lab in Wyoming. They came back with the result, male mountain lion. Told the state of New Hampshire, didn't keep any of his sample, but told the state of New Hampshire, and they actually had that lab in Wyoming issue a retraction about the findings. And then, of course, the sample was destroyed, and he just has a story now. And this guy, you know, is not somebody who really peddles these kind of conspiracy theories, but, you know, he kind of, in the email, I remember, he said, this was basically a conspiracy theory. I mean, this is a conspiracy full-fledged. So yeah, it just kind of goes to show that there's certain agendas that people have, and like I said, I don't think it's necessarily super sinister. I think a lot of it has to do with management and money. But I think it does kind of point in the direction that, yeah, people are not crazy when they're having these sightings and there are tangible evidence. I mean, somebody else I coincidentally met was a police officer in Connecticut who saw a mountain lion a few days before that particular cat was killed. I mean, it was just a chance encounter. I met him at a, you know, like a paranormal event last winter, and I was amazed. You know, I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I saw this thing. Nobody believed me. You know, I'm a police officer. I'm a trained observer. You know, you give him a little bit more credibility. He saw this thing. Nobody really believed him. And then a couple of days later, it was killed like 5 miles down the road. So,
I mean, that must be really frustrating. I mean, it's one of those things, Alex. I think it doesn't matter what kind of phenomenon you talk about that's classed as being a fringe subject, and you know, big cats existing where they're officially extinct isn't as far out as Bigfoot or Yowies or the Tasmanian tiger. But there is that constant rebuttal that seems to fit any witness that sees something they're not supposed to, even if it is something as, you know, we've used the word a couple of times, as mundane as a cougar sighting, because it's just a normal animal. It's just not where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. And that opens up a really interesting discussion that I've had quite a bit with people, because, you know, they'll ask me, they know I've worked on stuff like Champ of Lake Champlain and Loch Ness and mostly Bigfoot and other cryptozoological and paranormal phenomena. They say, oh, why mountain lions? I mean, is that, it's really not that unusual. I say, well, you know, if there's all this fuss about mountain lions, which are an established species that exists, that we know, that most people have seen video footage of in known populations, and yet hundreds and thousands of people are saying they're seeing them here. There's such a big fuss about this. What about something like a Bigfoot or some of these other mystery creatures or mystery phenomena that gets even weirder, that, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories about that kind of stuff. You know, what does it say about those subjects if something, again, to use that word, mundane, is treated with such contempt, and there's such a contentious debate. I mean, every year in New England, I've noticed every fall there's like a couple of local radio stations and newspapers that will do a big spread about mountain lions. There was just a really fantastic one done, and I think in the New England magazine, online magazine that I was just sent, and they did like a fantastic piece about it. Last fall they did one, or last winter, I remember I was interviewed for that. Year before that, it's like every year there's a news piece, there's some sort of radio piece, because people are fascinated in this subject, but it's so controversial. And then, you know, we'll talk about something like UFOs, and infinitely more controversial than big cats. Yet it just kind of goes to show that the mystery subjects and people, especially eyewitnesses, are not taken as seriously, and that there really could be something going on.
Yeah, I mean, They're a creature that have always fascinated me, because, you know, living in the UK, we're very spoilt here. You know, the most dangerous thing you might come across in England might be the occasional angry badger, which might not sound terrifying, but they're not animals to be trifled with. To be fair, if they fancy taking
a ferocious,
if they fancy taking a chunk out of your ankle, they will do, and they can be very aggressive and very territorial. And we sometimes are very flippant, you know. That's, I mean, obviously we mentioned hogs. We've got a similar thing in the south of England, in the Forest of Dean. There's a hog population that is building dangerously large, and it's sadly only a matter of time before something goes awry there, I think. But they're so hard to track that they can't find them. But it's, I think it's frustrating for these people in that aspect.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. I mean, It's one of those things. I mean, just this past, was it 2 weekends ago, I went camping up in northern Maine. Mm. Now, Maine is kind of this last frontier of the East, at least in my mind, because it's a very heavily forested state. Most of the people live closer to the coast and in the southern portion. And if you look at it, it's interesting. If you look at a map of light pollution at night, satellite map of the United States, you know, you'll see most of the East Coast is covered up and down with lights. Out west, you have these big patches of black, there's just nothing there. And there's really only one place on the East Coast, aside from Canada, I'm talking the United States, where there's just this big chunk of black, and that's northern Maine and northern New Hampshire. There's just hundreds of miles of nothing in some in very small communities. And I'd never really explored that area much, but you go up there in some of these back roads, I mean, you've got moose tracks all over the place, bear tracks, even with some of the snow coming down. And I had taken two of my friends actually from Mexico who were visiting. And, you know, it's a very kind of a big shock. One of the guys had never really been camping. And, you know, we're just sitting there at night and we hear a coyote start howling not far from the camp. And I look at one of the guy's face and he's, you know, like, oh, my God, that's kind of scary. And that's an area where I know there's been Bigfoot activity. And it just gives you an appreciation for what could be out there. And that coincidentally, that the town over from there last year, somebody took a video in Maine of a mountain lion crossing a icy pond. I mean, it's from very far away and it's hard to tell, but even some of the authorities that looked at it said, yeah, it looked very convincing to be a mountain lion. But you gain an appreciation when you're out there that you are not in your element, that this is not, you know, you're at nature's mercy, not only from the weather, but wildlife. I mean, not that wildlife is necessarily that scary. I mean, as somebody who spent a lot of time in the woods, I'm not particularly terrified, especially if you have a 12 gauge shotgun or something up at the side of camp when you're cooking your beef stew.
Yeah,
you shouldn't worry. But you know, you do hear these stories, especially with the Bigfoot stuff. I mean, I was just reviewing audio actually from a little camping thing I did in southern New Hampshire over the summer with a friend of mine. Just hadn't checked out the audio. We had had stuff moving around the camp all night. We had set up in a spot where there's a lot of weird history. There's like a gruesome murder that happened there. There's been UFO sightings in the area and Bigfoot encounters. And we had stuff moving around all night around the camp. And we just kind of chalked it up. It was small animals, you know, the whole night. I mean, because we're both into Bigfoot. So we're like, you know, this is obviously we can't let the confirmation bias get to us. This is, you know, we pushed into the woods. We pushed into the woods a couple of times and there's just nothing there. But we kept hearing movement multiple times around us. So we're like, okay, whatever. I mean, it wasn't freaky. We were just more interested in anything. And I'm reviewing the audio and my recorder only had about 30 minutes to record after we went settled in the tent to go to sleep. And I just hung it in the middle of the tent. And, you know, right as after you can hear us kind of, we settle down, go to sleep. At one point there's a clear knock that I captured. It was very clear. And it was, you know, not too far away. I mean, you could hear it pretty clearly, which is interesting. There's a couple other points where you could hear movement around the camp. But then unfortunately our snoring and moving around in the sleeping bags diminished any other sound that could be heard in that half hour. But it was very interesting. And that kind of, I told my friend and he was like, oh man, well, I have to check that spot out again. I'm like, yeah, there's something about that spot. It's weird. It's got a weird vibe. There's other sightings in the area. That's why I picked it. I've had some weird stuff happen to be there. So, yeah, but once you're out there, you really do gain a respect for the environment. And, you know, I love taking people out who have never really been out into the deep woods or thick woods and camping and that kind of thing, because I didn't really grow up doing that as much. I didn't really start doing that until high school. So once I started doing it on my own and being interested in these subjects, of course, it kind of lent itself pretty well.
I mean, I have to be brutally honest. Whenever I see anything about the forest and the national parks in the USA, it just takes my breath away, because it's incredible. I think everybody kind of, it's one of those things, I think, Alex, that a lot of people have this idea that there's two types of America. It's either, you know, deep south, everybody's drunk, sitting on porches, you know what I mean, that horrible cliched version of people that live in the south of the states, and then everybody lives in a major city and that's it. They are the two types of Americans for most outsiders. And I think when you see some of the, you know, the footage of some of the forested area, you know, like Oregon and Washington State and like you say, Maine, and down into places like Nevada and Arizona, it is simply breathtaking. The natural beauty. It's one of the most beautiful visual countries I can think of in the world. It is absolutely stunning. I know you did a travelogue, which was just some of the places you visited were just honestly just so awe-inspiring to see the vistas. It was amazing.
Yeah, no, it's a nature lover's paradise. I mean, I've traveled much of the country and seen, you know, from the deserts to the swamps down south to the entire green belt of the Appalachians, which stretches down from Georgia all the way up into eastern Canada, crosses through this whole section up and down. And that's obviously, there's a lot of high strangeness and high weirdness in the southern part of the United States, around the Appalachian Mountains, a lot of the caves, I think, too. And I've experienced some of that in Pennsylvania, too. But it's just amazing. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. Even in a small area like New England, I mean, Maine is the most forested state in the U.S. I think it's like 90%. New Hampshire is trailing right behind it, around 88. I mean, there's places I could take you to Maine or New Hampshire or Vermont, and even Massachusetts, some parts of eastern Massachusetts. You know, most people think of Massachusetts, they think Boston, but eastern part of the state, or western part of the state rather, there's plenty of forest. I could take you to a place where we could disappear and not be seen for days. And yet, the small area, compare that to out west or even Alaska. I mean, having been to Alaska, Alaska is just a world of its own. I mean, it's completely insane. But yeah, all these forests, all these lands, all this ancient territory, you know, there's a lot of stories, a lot of interesting creatures and Native American folklore and everything. I think that's what makes North America so paranormal or supernatural, if you will. There's so many different people have inhabited these areas, and people coming from, you know, towards the beginning of the country, primarily from European countries that were settling just vast swaths of wilderness. I mean, I go out in the woods in winter. It was just snowshoeing yesterday. We got almost 2 feet of snow. So it was the first sort of snowshoe of the season. I went last night, and you're out there in the middle of the woods. I can just imagine 400 years ago settling in an area like that in a cabin with your family. Just, you'd have to think about surviving. That was your primary focus. Yet all these folkloric stories of these creatures, and whether it's Bigfoot or whatever the case may be, there's so many stories. And I think that's what's so amazing about North America. And I love just exploring that. I mean, I can't get enough of it just in one region. But once you start looking in other places as well, there's just so many different landscapes and terrains you can look into.
Very. I mean, that's the thing as well. Like you say, when you think about those pioneers, you know, you deal with the bears and the cougars, and then you find out about Bigfoot and Wendigo. You're like, yeah. Wait, no thanks. I'll stay by the coast.
It's amazing. Yeah, that's what a lot of people did. And I think there are sort of two Americas. I mean, not only politically now, there's definitely a big divide between urban and rural areas. But every single state, I'd say, in America, even Rhode Island, which is small, every state has a sort of backwoods hillbilly culture, if you will, whether it's in the deserts or the swamps or up in northern Maine, where it's a lot different than Boston, than around Harvard University, you know. So it's been interesting, you know, my whole life kind of straddling between those two and seeing what the country has to offer. And, you know, I'll take the nature side, because I love to just be tucked off somewhere and explore, you know, what there is to be seen. So it's wonderful.
Yeah. And like I say, I think it gives you that perspective as well when, you know, like we mentioned, you've got two apex predators out there who, you know, when you think of the amount of people that visit the national parks and go hiking and trekking and camping, fatal interactions with bears are rare. With cougars, they're almost, well, they're not unheard of. I think there's something like 27 cases in the last 100 years in the States. It's they're nowhere near as many as you would suspect.
At least the known ones. I mean, I'm sure there's unknown ones and people that, you know, their body wasn't found in an area where they could have told their story, which is unfortunate. But yeah, it just, you know, you really, you hear about that and it's a little unsettling. But I think for the most part, I'm honestly, when I'm in the woods, I'm more worried about encountering people are deranged or something weird going on. That's probably my primary concern. It's not necessarily wildlife.
This is very true. I think, as you say, if you've had the thought of going for a wander, there's a good chance someone else probably has as well, and they may not be the type of people that you would really like to bump into in a urban environment. Never mind in the middle of a wood, I would suspect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, that's the thing. As we say about cougars, there was obviously the one, because, like you say, that the fatal attacks are so rare. I think that the one that strikes me was the unfortunate lady last year who was mountain biking in Washington. And I saw a documentary about that. And the thing that was very surprising about that was she wasn't on her own. She'd just gotten ahead of a friend, I think, who was also biking with her. And two other people were hiking. And I think the two people who'd been hiking had seen the cat scouting about and thought it had disappeared. And the next thing they heard was obviously this poor woman screaming as it pounced on her as she rode past it.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible when you hear a story like that. But I think what's interesting about it is you do have these attacks, but like you said, they're pretty rare. out in those areas, in those states, people deal with mountain lions all the time. I mean, when I was out in Colorado over the summer visiting a friend of mine, we were, you know, 6 miles up a really bad road in the pickup truck camping out in a spot where, you know, it was definitely mountain lion, big cat country and sort of ridges where they hang out. But people learn to deal with it. And I think out east, it's an interesting point that was brought up by a guy who used to work for the Massachusetts, he was an environmental officer. And he said, you know, he's seen a mountain lion. He's been gathering evidence as well over the years. And this guy, he's a bit of an old schooler, you know, old timer. He was saying, you know, it's almost a disservice. And I think I included this clip, actually, was in the trailer. He said it's a disservice to the public because the states should just say that there is a real possibility, more so than they're kind of haphazardly admitting that there may be these transient mountain lions coming in from the west. Just say that they're here and teach people how to deal with it, because you don't want to have two negative reactions. First of all, you don't want to have people just being scared and terrified of going out in the woods, and that creates a fear of the woods. You want people to understand the necessary steps, just like we do with bear or moose, which moose can actually be very aggressive. That's the biggest animal we have in New England. And I've seen videos of moose attacking snowmobilers, and you know, the guy has to pull out a pistol and shoot it. They can get very aggressive, and they're very big animals. And then the second reaction, aside from the fear, is then the, I want to say, anger or trigger happy response, where you have stories of mountain lion and everyone in town grabs their guns, and it becomes a scene out of one of those, you know, monster movies where they're all hunting. And that's a point that was brought up by a biologist as well, who mentioned to me saying, you know, look at the gray wolf. So the gray wolves are also one of these species that are extirpated in New England, but there's populations of them right across the St. Lawrence River in Canada and Quebec. Mm. And ostensibly they have crossed the river and have come into New England. I've talked to people who claim to see wolves as well, not only just coyotes. But there was a wolf that was killed in central Massachusetts a few years ago. And I think the biologist mentioned, you know, wolves won't have a chance to set up home here, because as soon as they do, people are out in the woods and ready with their guns to start killing them and collecting them. So there, you know, there almost needs to be more of a regulatory or a public dialogue about what needs to be done about not only wolves, but obviously mountain lions, which are way different than wolves themselves. So you don't want to have those two reactions. And unfortunately, those are pretty much the reactions we have at the moment.
Mm. And I think that once again feeds into the train of thought that there's some kind of conspiracy here, Alex, because that would seem like a logical defense for them to not officially admit they exist, because one of those two reactions will happen.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, you'd be amazed the amount of people who just routinely, nonchalantly just write it off and say, oh yeah, they know they're here, they're bringing them in. Like I said, that's a very common motif that I've heard time and time again. It's like one of those sort of things you just always hear about a certain subject. And it just keeps popping up that, oh, they were brought in to control the deer, and now they're out of control. I mean, I guess it's not impossible for a government agency to do something like that, but it's – you know, it's a bit of a stretch, but I suppose it's possible. You know, you don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not claiming to be an expert on this or anything. And, you know, I don't want people to start kind of coming after me for it's what I've observed from researching this phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, I've heard people say exactly the same thing when it comes to the thylacine, Alex. And they say the reason they'll never admit that they're there is exactly because of those two reasons. People either think it's going to attack and eat domestic pets, or loads of people are going to go out and try and bag one and make themselves an overnight millionaire.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's until something else happens, I mean, it just kind of seems like the status quo will be maintained, so to speak.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And it's the thing, you know, like we briefly touched on about the melanistic aspects of these, is that when I was fortunate enough to speak to Tony Healy the other week, he's obviously done a lot of research into ABCs in Australia. And we were kind of saying that there is a train of thought when it comes to the black ones, that it's a paranormal experience more than an actual physical one, which we were then both sort of coming to the same conclusion that if this is like a European tradition that's manifested itself in North America because of immigration over the centuries, and these people have brought these stories with them from Europe, Why are people not seeing giant black dogs running around the forests of New England and Maine, or Australia or England? It's big black cats. And I've always found that a very perplexing sort of rebuttal to the it's a superstitious paranormal thing.
Yeah, I mean that's a good question. I have heard actually reports of big black dogs
They just
in
ruined
the
my
British
point. Thank you.
Archipelago. And once you get into the whole dogman thing, but I don't know.
Yes.
If you think about what's interesting is just, I mean, even just something like the dogman and sort of the areas that it's seen, and you have in Louisiana the Rougarou, and obviously that's where French-speaking people settled, Cajuns, who were descendants of the Acadians, who were French settlers to Canada. And then obviously in France you have the legends of the Bête de Gévaudan, the sort of the werewolf. Have these stories. I mean, maybe they are manifestations, maybe not in a physical sense, or maybe not in a folkloric sense, but I don't know. I mean, it's just interesting to think about, at least for me, I've gone through a little bit of an evolution, I'd say, in some ways, having experienced some strange stuff in an area in Pennsylvania that's one of these sort of flap areas where it's sort of Bridgewater Triangle-esque, where you have Bigfoot sightings going on with orbs and UFOs and people seeing black helicopters and all this kind of stuff. And I think a lot of people are noticing these sorts of things across the country. I mean, whether it's Skinwalker Ranch or whatever area, or is it the possibility that, something like the Beast of Bray Road is a Germanic folktale that's brought into existence by some sort of, occult activity? I mean, I don't know. I mean, Aleister Crowley was in New England and a lot of areas that have had strange things happen. So, that's a whole other kind of path you go down, but I have heard with the Black Panther phenomenon, there is a bit of a paranormal association with it, which I think is interesting. Now, I don't talk a lot about that in the documentary, but definitely mentioning it just a little bit because that's, something that people do mention. And I've heard of encounters of people seeing Bigfoot and the Black Panther kind of in the same vicinity. And a guy I just interviewed recently had a lot of weird Bigfoot activity at his house and also had seen a mountain lion on the property. I'm not saying they're directly correlated, but he actually had oysters that were just showing up in the woods, and he lives nowhere near the ocean. It was, something was digging out of someone's trash and leaving it there, and he had handprints on the side of his house. I actually got some pretty interesting pictures of that, but then he also claimed to have a mountain lion sighting. So, I mean, I don't know what's going on. Is it just that it's a wooded area and that a lot of this kind of stuff is attracted to that area? Very possible, but once you down the path of the flap areas and that sort of stuff, it gets pretty interesting.
Absolutely, and that's weird once again because there's a very strange parallel. There's a lot of that with the Yowies in Australia and big black cats, seen in very similar areas, which is quite unusual to see that the same kind of thing. I mean, I've heard that before. I mean, I've also heard that Bigfoots keep cougars as pets, but
Yeah,
you
I've heard that.
don't believe everything you read online. But
Yeah.
it's my advice with that, and that's a whole different tangent. But it is weird how it, like you say, you can kind of push the black cat phenomenon to one side because I think, like you've referred to, you touch on it slightly in the new documentary. But the meat and bones of the subject is the reality of the cougar returning to its former glory.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you're very strictly, a natural phenomenon that's just evoking a lot of different theories and a lot of different possibilities. But there is that Black Panther element, which I think is intrinsically part of it, but it's directly related. I mean, maybe it's possible that there are melanistic mountain lions. I mean, nature finds a way, right? It's possible that's the case. Can it all just be escaped pets? I mean, I don't think every single Black Panther that's seen across, various regions are all exotic pets that have been released, certainly a portion of them. But I think the whole Black Panther thing almost is a separate subject of its own, or at least deserves like a documentary or more of a dedication strictly to that. Because it gets very weird, and there's a lot of, I mean, I was sent a couple of interesting cases. A friend of mine, Colin Schneider, kind of the crypto kid, that's what he calls himself, about all the beast of, Bladensboro, North Carolina, a lot of these stories in Appalachia down there in the mountains of Black Panthers attacking and killing livestock and all sorts of very strange tales. And I think that almost kind of warrants investigating of its own.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it seems to have its pause in quite a few different types of Fortean phenomena there, because it does seem to sort of skip between several different subjects. You can't really pin down the experiences in a lot of them because there's something odd about people's response in that in those situations with those witness sightings, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very fascinating, once you start looking into that. And black cats again are something that's always associated with the paranormal, right? You see a black cat, I mean, around Halloween, everyone's always talking about them, but black panthers, there's this definite sort of mystical quality around them. And I think a lot of ancient cultures realize that and worship that, whether it's the Sphinx cat in or the kind of the black cats in Egypt and that sort of thing, and how it was mystified. And cats are very interesting animals. I mean, we have this dichotomy between cats and dogs, and if you look through history, with wolves and werewolves and then panthers, and it's just a very fascinating kind of examination of human fascination with these subjects.
Yeah, I mean, was there a point during the filming, Alex, where you were just basically convinced by the witnesses? I mean, because I would imagine it's you've got to start yourself, as you said about confirmation bias earlier with Bigfoot. I think it's always you've got to go into this subject balanced and try and suppress what you may believe, but. Was it an early part of the process where you kind of thought, yeah, there's something weird going on? Or was there kind of a light bulb moment halfway through, or were you kind of open to the possibility once you started?
Yeah, that's a good question. I maybe it's a little combination of everything. I think I went into it believing that, yeah, there were mountain lions. I mean, I had multiple people in my life that before I was even into cryptozoology in sort of a public sense that had told me about their stories that were very convincing. And I had no reason to believe that they weren't telling the truth. So I kind of accepted, yeah, there are probably mountain lions in New England. I mean, we have the space for it now. The resources are abundant. And as I kind of got into it, I think what surprised me was that conspiracy element more than anything. That's the sort of moment. I think one of the biggest moments was interviewing the lady there with the horse attack. And when I saw the paperwork and you're seeing like a lab DNA sheet that's telling you exactly that it's, what you've found, what the species is. And that was kind of a moment where I'm like, huh, this is like real tangible stuff. I mean, you can't very hard to fake this sort of stuff. Or embellish it rather. So that was a moment, and definitely, like I said, just the whole sort of conspiracy element of, but talking to Fish and Game and people that are working in those capacities, also it kind of showed me that they're not just these faceless machines that work for the government. They're just normal people that in some cases, it's almost like a Mulder kind of thing. Like they want to believe they're stuck in a system. They're looking into it, but they can't really, because of higher ups, perhaps go into it. But and I think that, and it has to be balanced because they don't want to start a panic or a hysteria around it. So it was definitely a bit of an evolution. Now I'm in a place where I'm much more able to accept that they are definitely mountain lions at this moment in New England. I don't know where or how many, but they are here, and that there is somewhat of a concerted cover-up to kind of keep it in the shadows, I guess you could say. I don't know. I'm just going to keep looking and keep seeing the reception with the public about after this project, especially, and then just the interest that's always coming out about this sort of topic. So I'll just, my eyes will be peeled, even though I'll move on to other subjects. It'll definitely be something that's, it's always there.
Yeah, I think there is something fascinating that there does seem to be a real appetite in the general public for these kind of stories and hopes for things like the cougar, despite the fact that, like we say, that there would be some general fear if you realise that there was something that had moved into the neighbourhood that hadn't been there for decades. But people seem to be. It's as almost as if they're really interested as long as it doesn't happen near them, if you know what I
Yeah,
mean.
I agree. I think a lot of times people are probably rooting for the mountain lions, and it's in a lot of cases, you look at the modern world and how much control seemingly corporations and technology has over our lives, and the world is becoming managed. And I think that's what attracts a lot of people like ourselves to these subjects, is that there's this yearning for the mysterious. Whereas something like a mountain lion, I mean, it's pretty simple, but it's moving back into New England or moving into the eastern United States. It's like a nature is just kind of giving us the middle finger in a way and saying, you don't control this world. You have to remember you're still at our you are at our mercy, basically. I think that, and a lot of people, that may be kind of humbling. I know it certainly is for me, that nature does find a way, despite how many setbacks and how much we, destroy our environment or whatever the case may be. There's that element. I think a lot of people, particularly something like a mountain lion, like I mentioned earlier at events, I'll get a lot of people that tell me about their mountain lion stories, much less reluctantly than Bigfoot or UFOs, because, it's real. We know that they exist. Whereas something with a UFO, a person really has to get more comfortable with you and understand your intentions, I feel like, before they tell you their story. And that's something I've encountered with Bigfoot and other mystery phenomena as well. They gauge you first to kind of see where you're at. Mm-hmm. Whereas a mountain lion, you say, my grandfather talked about him all the time in Western Massachusetts when I was growing up. He would be out hunting and see him all the time. That's one example of a story I've heard or whatever. Other kind of stories, very, very similar, a lot of overlap and a lot of pattern, but it's a way that we're kind of losing control in a little bit, because you go out in the woods and you think, we manage it. But this mountain lion, I think, that was killed in, virtually less than an hour from New York City, that's just the ultimate sort of irony. You have this concrete jungle and then this apex predator just lurking around in some of the richest parts of America in people's backyards, probably trying to feast on their pets. It's just a very ironic kind of thing.
Yeah, because every time there seems to be, I think that the most recent example that I can think of is the one that was alleged to be living in the Hollywood Hills, and people said, oh no, it's absolute nonsense. No, of course there's no cougar, wouldn't live in such a residential area. And then all of a sudden, it was on about four different CCTV systems in a week.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, even with the Connecticut cat, which is an interesting point you bring up, supposedly that particular cat was seen in Pennsylvania, possibly upstate New York and Massachusetts on game cameras and other areas. So, I don't know if that was all the same cat, but that's the story that we're told, that you can track its progress, however many months it took to get over to the where it met its demise. But then make think about how many other lone males are there like that, are just wandering around looking to start a family. They have abundant resources, and maybe they get hit by a car and just go off in the side of the road and die, and you don't hear about it.
Yep.
You just kind of hear about this one because it's so prolific, or this one with the game cameras and all this kind of stuff. So
go on after you. Sorry, Alex.
No, just a vast subject. And, like I said, I thought it was going to be a lot more cut and dry when I first got into it. It's definitely got its nuances and complexities.
Yeah, because I think the aspect, like we've mentioned about rangers and stuff, but there's a fantastic example of the cat mentality that's in the news this week about the tiger in India that's being tracked, and that's walked over 800 miles in a year just having a wander about. And that's the first time anybody's really tracked anybody doing that. They think it's a juvenile just having a wander about looking for a mate and just finding his surroundings. But 800 miles he's covered in that period. You would guarantee it's probably not in a straight line either.
Yeah, and that's cats fascinating. For some reason that brought up a story in my mind that I've heard of this past spring, the International Cryptozoology Conference, by one of the keynote speakers there, Dr. Anna Nakaris, who's actually there at Oxford. You've probably heard of her. She's been on some of the Bigfoot programs. She studies slow lorises. Well, she brought up a story of an area where they were studying kind of animals in this, I think it was in Sumatra or Indonesia, where it was like an island and most of the forest had been ravaged and there wasn't a lot of forest land left. Well, another biologist approached her doing research on jaguars, another big cat, saying, oh, can I use your area as a test, because, like a safety check, because there's going to be no animals, no jaguars in this area. It's too small. It's not conducive for them. So I'll just use it as like a test area, and then compare it to other areas where there possibly are. Well, on the game cameras that they were using to look for these little primates, little monkey-like creatures, slow lorises, they actually got pictures of a jaguar, and it managed to survive in this very small area that pretty much nobody believed that it could live in. And I think that goes back to the nature will find a way kind of motif to, Jurassic Park, quote, Jeff Goldblum on this. But
oh, dearie me. So when's it coming out?
So I'm looking for a January release around that time, if I can hopefully get it all figured out with Amazon and I think I'll probably go to Amazon and some of the streaming sites first, and then have the DVD sort of right after that.
Fantastic. Have you got another trailer lined up before that, or?
I have a small teaser, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So, what's next for you then after this? And now this is coming to its fruition. What's the next subject that's kind of taking your fancy, Alex?
Oh, there's too many. As I'm sure you well know, I
Absolutely.
contemplated doing a book maybe on the Bigfoot phenomenon in New Hampshire. I'm still toying around with that idea. No one's really done that, I suppose, about New Hampshire specifically. Just, I do this talk a lot about Granite State Bigfoot, and I've been very interested in this subject, for a while. Pretty interesting cases. So I thought about maybe putting that to pen and paper. Aside from that, just sort of other projects. I mean, I was lucky enough to be involved with, yet again with Small Town Monsters, with On the Trail of UFOs. It'll be coming out this spring, so keep your eyes peeled for that, because that's going to be pretty phenomenal. We were filming up here in October. I mean, Seth and the gang, they filmed all across the country, up and down the East Coast, and then they all came up to New Hampshire, and we filmed about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, of course, and the area surrounding that, some night investigations. And then connection with Roswell and one of the Air Force bases here in New Hampshire. So very interesting. And I got to talk about my UFO sighting that I had in Pennsylvania this past May. End of May. So that's going to be a great project. Aside from that, just keeping busy. Other adventures. Lots of hiking and camping and that kind of stuff planned. And definitely going to be looking more into, like I said, the Bigfoot subject a little bit more as well.
Fantastic. Well, I always look forward to being updated with what you're planning next. So I wish you continued success with that, and I'm looking forward to the UFO series as well. I think we've all been keeping his eye on that one, and some of the guests they've pulled in for that. I think it could be something spectacular myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an honor to be featured alongside people that are, much more in knowledge or in the know about the UFO subject than myself. I got into it pretty much very reluctantly because of my experience. I was always more on the cryptozoology side, but like I said earlier, I've evolved a little bit in my thinking because of this strange area that I've now been researching with some friends of mine in Pennsylvania. That's just very anomalous, and it's got everything going on in the same area. So.
Yeah, I think we're about to enter a golden age of our favourite subjects, I think, Alex. Over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, I think there's been a real boom. I think the rise of social media and the self-funded filmmaker, I think, has kind of come into its own, and it's good to see that there are so many people out there who love the weird as much as you and I.
Yeah, it's been a very uniting thing. I mean, obviously sometimes it can be divisive in certain communities with these sorts of subjects, but that's natural, that humans are tend to divide each other. It's sort of something we can never really get rid of. But I think it's going to be interesting. You have all these amazing documentaries and shows that are coming out independent, and even hopefully TV starts moving more into a direction where it's more about the respecting of the subjects and back to the roots. I want to go back to the In Search of days and that kind of stuff. And a lot of our independent stuff has filled that void of the reality crap that's just been all over the place. So I think we're going to see a lot of cool stuff coming up in the next few years. And maybe even people start shifting their attitudes about what is evidence. Some of these subjects are just so intangible that it's just, like a mountain lion, I could probably, I really tried, prove it at some point. But something like the UFO encounter I had, I don't know how to explain that in a material way. There just really isn't anything I can do. It's just kind of just video and experience. That's pretty much it.
I mean, you were very kind to let me see that footage. I was it's very odd. I can't explain it. It's one of the most unusual things anybody's ever sent me as footage.
Yeah, no, I think that was like the day after it happened. I think we were just talking, but if people are curious, I have a full write-up of the entire encounter and the stills and the whole video on my website, and it will be featured in the On the Trail of UFOs as well, and possibly some other stuff. I have some other projects that might involve that as well. So there's a lot. It's interesting. It's an interesting time for not only that subject, but just the whole paranormal cryptozoology world in general, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And all power to everybody involved. I think I'm looking forward to getting my teeth stuck into most of it. So where can everybody keep up with you, Alex? I know you've touched on your blog and your YouTube, but remind everybody where they can keep up to date with everything.
Sure, yeah, the best place is my website, just petakovmedia.com, PTAKOV media.com. I've got everything on there, links to all the social media, blog, photos, whatever. Also YouTube. My YouTube channel is Sasquatch Out of the Shadows. I think I just got like over 2,000 subscribers, which I didn't really expect, but that's a cool place if you want to see just some sort of long form interviews with people. I just put up an interview with Dana Holyfield of the kind of the Honey Island Swamp Monster case in Louisiana, and it's just probably more in depth than you've ever seen her talking, because people had mentioned to me, they'd seen her on various programs on TV, and it's 2 minutes interview. It's very short. In this, just like 8 minutes of pretty much just no editing, just talking, a little bit of B-roll and music, and that's about it. So I have a lot more videos coming up on that channel as well.
Ah, fantastic. Well, listen, really looking forward to seeing the new documentary in its entirety. So no doubt you'll let us all know when it's out.
Don't worry.
Fantastic. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining me. And like I say, all the very best with the film. And if I don't get a chance to speak to you before, I hope you and yours have a wonderful Christmas and a very happy new year. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Thank you. Likewise, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure.